From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Islamic State releases a video showing them destroying antiquities in Iraq. They say it's for religious reasons. We speak with an archaeologist who disputes that. Ukrainian leaders are wary of opposition participation in a ceasefire in their country. And the school essay being turned in by a U.S. or British student may have been written by someone in Kenya. It's all ahead. I'm Ira Melman. There seems to be no limit to the atrocities committed by radical Islamists in their intent to create a world designed according to their own interpretation of Islam. As Islamic State militants continue on their destructive path, experts are saying they're ready to destroy anyone or anything that does not fit their vision. Latika Hoek reports.
Islamic State released a video on Thursday purportedly showing militants destroying ancient artifacts in Iraq's northern city of Mosul. Some works were older than 2,000 years and their value was incalculable. One of the men shown in the five-minute video says statues were destroyed because they were, as he said, religious idols of the Assyrians and Arcadians, the ancient peoples that did not believe in one God. He says the Prophet Muhammad ordered the destruction of all such religious symbols. Islamic State follows a strict version of Sunni Islam and does not tolerate what it sees as deviation from the Quran. The group has destroyed holy sites of Shiite and Sufi Muslims, as well as Christian churches in the parts of Iraq and Syria under their control. But it is the destruction of human life that concerns the world more than material destruction. The militants have published grisly videos of their terrorist campaign, including beheadings of captives. U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, David Saperstein, told Al Hura Television they are destroying diverse communities in Iraq and Syria that have traditionally lived side by side in peace and mutual respect.
They want a monolithic extremist view of Islam imposed on everyone and are prepared to drive out those or kill those who do not agree with them.
Muslims who think differently are not spared brutality, and neither are women or children.
Children of minorities have been captured in many places, have been in places where their so-called ISIL has its strengths, have been sold in the marketplace with taps, price tags on them, have been sold as slaves.
The United Nations reports that children captured by Islamic State face a brutal fate.
We had reports of children, especially children that are mentally challenged, who have been used as suicide bombers, most probably without them even understanding. There was a video that showed children on very young age, approximately 8 years of age and younger, to be trained already to become child soldiers.
Yet the radical Islamist propaganda seems to appeal to some young Muslims worldwide. As governments work to prevent people from traveling to Syria to join Islamic State, many are calling for greater efforts to combat radicalization. Slarica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
When the Islamic State released a video of its members desecrating antiquities in and around Mosul, a narrative explained that it was done due to an Islamic ban on idolatry. However, more than that is involved, according to one who has investigated the situation. I spoke with Michael Dante, co-director for cultural heritage and communications at Boston University. He's been working with the U.S. State Department in an effort to stop the ravaging of ancient works of art.
As we can see it, primarily from satellite imagery, is that archaeological sites throughout Syria are being looted. It's extensive looting, and it's very intensive, in some cases, industrial-scale looting. Standing architectural remains are being looted as well, as are collections of cultural objects from museums, libraries, and other cultural repositories. At the same time, Islamist militants are looting cultural property, things that aren't necessarily antiquities, but do have cultural significance to particular ethnic and religious groups. That's also appearing on the market. So we have satellite imagery that shows the looting. We have reliable in-country accounts of the looting and the fact that it's occurring everywhere. Most of the primary belligerents in Syria are engaged in looting and cultural property crimes. On the opposite side of it, in countries like Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, we're beginning to see antiquities cropping up in the illicit market. There are established trafficking networks for these illicit antiquities that existed before the conflict started in 2011. But obviously, the breakdown in the rule of law and the introduction of jihadi Salafi transnational crime networks has served as a capacity builder for cultural property crime throughout Syria and northern Iraq. Linking the two is difficult. On the one hand, we have the supply side, and we can see that there is massive looting occurring. On the other side, we can see the beginnings of the antiquities cropping up in the market, and the operating assumption there on the demand side is that we are seldom going to see these antiquities, and those that we do see are really the tip of the iceberg and what's available on the market.
Is this solely being done for financial gain by the group doing this or the groups doing this, or are there other reasons involved?
There are other reasons involved in a lot of the cultural property crime that we're seeing, including the looting. One is that it is a form of psychological warfare. The deliberate destruction of heritage places is probably the most infamous example of this. There have been perhaps 60 intentional destructions of heritage places by jihadi Salafists. There have been a large number of intentional attacks on heritage places by the Syrian regime, for example. Cultural property crimes on a smaller scale, like looting, looting of households and cultural objects, is a way to try to stamp out cultural diversity. It's a way to terrorize the opponents of jihadi Salafist groups or other opponents. For example, with ISIL, what we see is the targeting of Sufi, Shia, and Yazidis and Kurds for this kind of looting. So there's a psychological element to it. The destruction of heritage places and objects plays into that. It's a way for this particular brand of jihadi Salafists to tout their credentials to the larger community that is engaged in these sorts of acts in Syria and Iraq. There's a lot of competition among jihadi Salafist groups. Again, it's a way to terrorize their opponents. And it perhaps, although this is highly hypothetical, but we should never rule out the possibility with groups like Islamic State or Jabhat al-Nusra, that these are also transnational crime networks, and much of what they do is simply to make money. And there may be a financial angle in the destruction of cultural property as well, in that they can extort money by not destroying cultural property. They can extort money from ethnic and religious minorities. This would be a version of jizya, with a tax that is imposed on non-Muslims. Although there's very little information with regard to this particular practice, there does seem to be patterns in the targeting of material culture by jihadi Salafist groups throughout the region. It's a target-rich environment for them, and they do seem to prioritize the sites that they target for destruction.
Secretary Kerry said something must be done about this. What is or what can be done about it?
I think I've been doing this now. I've been reporting to the State Department for 28 weeks on a weekly basis on what's going on in Syria and northern Iraq. And obviously our options are somewhat limited, especially when we're working remotely. A lot of brave men and women in Syria, Syrians in Iraq, Syrians and Iraqis are doing everything they can at the local level to try to save material culture. That isn't enough, and they recognize that. I think everyone in the cultural heritage sphere recognizes that. In practical terms, I think that more steps need to be taken to close the borders coming out of Syria, particularly the northern border with Turkey. And beyond that, I would say that a primary focus should be to close the border in towns like Tel Abyad in northern Syria, where there is a steady flow of people and arms and almost certainly antiquities going from Syria to Turkey, and obviously people and arms coming from Turkey into Syria, Tel Abyad. Recent satellite imagery that I looked at showed that essentially there were holes in the border fence. And these holes correlated with paths that converged on what is almost certainly a fortified position that ISIL has on the Syrian side of the border. And I've heard lots of reports that gangs in Turkey are working very closely with ISIL to provide them with what they need. So very practical steps would be to try to, in the international community, to take steps to close these borders. And it's a difficult task given the humanitarian crisis that we're coping with now and a lot of other considerations.
Michael Dante, an archaeologist at Boston University working with the U.S. State Department trying to curtail or halt the looting and destruction of antiquities by Islamic extremist groups in the Mideast. Our reporting stays in the area now as President Barack Obama used a recent White House summit on countering extremism to refute the narrative being pushed by terrorist groups that there is a conflict between the West and Islam.
We are not at war with Islam. We are at war with people who have perverted Islam.
The West versus Islam theme has enjoyed some success in attracting alienated or disaffected young people who are ripe for radicalization. Philip P.J. Crowley served as Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs in the Obama administration. He spoke to about strategies for responding to the stream of propaganda and conspiracy theories that infects the media landscape, particularly in the Middle East.
Mr. Crowley, how could the United States win hearts and minds when ISIS is targeting young Muslims with such claims as the West is at war with Islam and the U.S. is supporting regimes that suppress Islamists?
Well, the United States has to be part of an international effort to try to counter the Islamic State's messaging and to convince young people, many in the West, that conditions in the Islamic State world are not as idyllic as they're being described. I don't think that the Islamic State is quite as effective in its messaging as people have suggested. They're not 10 feet tall. They still represent a very narrow band of thinking within the Islamic world. Their message can be effectively countered. The most important thing is to change the dynamic on the ground. That will do as much as anything in beginning the process of delegitimizing the Islamic State. It is going to take time. I'm confident over time we will see its appeal fade, just as we have in other circumstances.
But what can be done in the short term to counter Islamic State propaganda?
Obviously, for all of us, we have circles of friends, acquaintances, family, and these are the voices that we listen to most attentively. So, you know, the Islamic State is no different. They're the new flavor within the Islamic world. You know, they're showing, you know, some staying power, but they can be defeated. I think that the United States can play a role in this, but ultimately, you know, the most credible voices are going to be within the Islamic world. It starts with major authority figures, you know, in the Middle East. We've had very strong statements from a range of influential people, you know, from the Grand Mufti in Saudi Arabia to the President of Egypt. And we need to continue to have authority figures, you know, speak out, you know, consistently in condemning what the Islamic State is doing. But that message also has to filter down community by community, country by country, and over time, you know, help people understand that, you know, what the Islamic State is describing is a mirage.
How about social media, which ISIS used successfully to manipulate young people?
The social media is a tool that the Islamic State has used, but it's not the be-all, end-all. You know, I don't think social media has been the Islamic State's silver bullet, and I don't think necessarily social media, you know, will be the Islamic State's downfall. They have had a remarkable track record over the past couple of years. They are controlling significant territory within Syria and Iraq, and I think it's important to take back that territory. And then when, you know, the Iraqi state does,
it needs to govern more effectively than it has before. You know, this will ultimately be a very critical dimension. And then obviously, if you know, the state of Iraq, you know, begins to roll back the Islamic State's gains, that's going to be a very compelling message and convince people that the Islamic State's fallible and they can be defeated, just as we have defeated other, you know, similar extremist movements in the past.
For the past few weeks, a number of Arabic language social media users have been spreading fake excerpts of Hillary Clinton's book, claiming she conceded that the U.S. helped engineer the Islamic State group. Who should encounter such rumors that instigate anti-American sentiments?
The United States has been victimized by any number of outrageous rumors and conspiracy theories over the years. I'm not sure that there's an immediate antidote to this. I think that over time, the United States has developed a credibility problem in the Middle East. It's still there. Some of it's deserved, some of it's not. And we just have to rebuild trust and credibility over time. And I think the partnership that has been formed to combat the Islamic State is an important element of this. And we, you know, from an American standpoint, we have to narrow the gap between what we are perceived to say and what we are perceived to do. And that's achievable, but it's not going to be something that can be turned around overnight. This is a long, painful process of rebuilding American credibility. We're probably in a better position than we were, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, but we still got a lot of work to do.
VOA senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawy talking with Philip P.J. Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs in the Obama administration. From the Voice of America in Washington, you're listening to International Edition. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko says his military is ready to return its heavy weapons to the front lines in eastern Ukraine, noting that Russian-backed rebels are still violating the ceasefire deal reached earlier this month. Mr. Poroshenko said Friday Ukraine's army is ready at any moment to stand up to the enemy. Meanwhile, a Ukrainian military spokesman said three government soldiers had been killed and seven wounded over the past day. That follows two consecutive days when no soldiers were killed. Mr. Poroshenko said a military threat from the east will remain even if the truce holds, an obvious reference to Russia. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Friday there has been progress in the withdrawal of heavy weapons in eastern Ukraine. He stressed the importance of fulfilling other aspects of the truce, including key humanitarian issues and constitutional reform in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine. More than you may be aware, academic work being submitted at high schools and universities in the United States and Europe is increasingly being made in Kenya. High school assignments to doctorate-level papers. Kenyan freelance writers are doing the work for Western students at a fee. VOA's Gabe Josselo has more on this secretive and controversial industry.
A cyber cafe just outside of Nairobi serves as an informal office for Kenyans working on academic assignments from abroad. Charles Kipkarir owns the shop and makes his money serving as a middleman connecting students in the West with Kenyan writers.
And it can go up to $50 per page, depending on the agency, even $82 per page.
Please insert media to continue.
How much would you can you make in a month doing this kind of work?
Okay, if you've got, let's say, if you've got 50 clients, you make millions in terms of Kenyan shillings.
Right.
Yeah. But actually, guys who will make about more than $10,000 in a week. Yes.
Most of the orders, he says, come from the United States, Britain, Canada, and Australia. A lot of his clients are students who speak English as a second language. He shows us the websites where he finds open orders. The assignments range from high school papers to PhD dissertations across all subjects. One project he recently finished was a creative writing assignment based around the work of two famous astronomers.
So this one says, write a fictional pair of one-page letters between Kepler and Galileo.
Yes, astronomy.
Wow. So you did this one, it says you 3 days to do it.
Yes.
Wow. And then they paid you how much for that one? $300?
Yes.
Wow.
Kip Creer says one of the toughest assignments of his writing career was a master's level paper on a particularly relevant topic.
It was something on ethics. I think so, yeah. It was really tough because I actually did about 7 revisions on that.
Writers here are doing nothing illegal, but for the client students, hiring another person to do your work breaks the most essential rules of academic ethics. Anyone caught using this service would likely face severe academic consequences at most universities. Some Kenyan writers do struggle with a moral dilemma.
Sometimes I wouldn't even want to tell somebody that I was actually doing it.
This is Pauline Chepkwani, a University of Nairobi graduate with a degree in sociology and a master's in foreign affairs. She used to write academic papers to help pay for university.
It wasn't really illegal, but you know, there's that conscience, you know. It's not right. This is not my assignment. I'm not supposed to be doing it. If you look at it from a moral or ethical perspective, it's kind of, yeah, it's not right.
Chepkwani says she is embarrassed to tell people about the kind of work she used to do, even though it did help her gain the skills she needed to ace her own writing assignments.
I didn't have any trouble, you know, somebody, a lecturer just tells me, no, go and do this, and I didn't have such a rough time. It's like I just had all the skills I needed to complete it. So actually, it helped me. For me, it really did. In fact, I've even been helping other students who are doing their projects and theses. I've been helping them at a fee, of course.
The industry seems to be booming. Jobs are advertised on flyers posted across the University of Nairobi campus using code words like online researcher to try to attract talented writers. One first-year student said the whole thing feels like a misuse of local brain power. But right or wrong, as long as students abroad are willing to pay somebody else to do their work, academic outsourcing looks like it is here to stay. Gabe Josselow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The International Criminal Court has upheld its acquittal of Congolese militia leader Mathieu N'Godjolo, 2 years after finding him not guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. In a 3-2 majority ruling, the Hague-based court Friday rejected an appeal by prosecutors who had wanted a retrial in the case. N'Godjolo was charged in connection with a 2003 massacre at a village that left about 200 people dead in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Many of those victims were hacked to death with machetes. Prosecutors allege that N'Godjolo used child soldiers, directed attacks against civilians, and that combatants under his command committed murder, rape, and acts of pillaging and sexual slavery. The ICC ruled in December of 2012 that prosecutors had failed to prove N'Godjolo's connection beyond a reasonable doubt. It was only the court's second verdict and the first time it has cleared a suspect. Fighting over natural resources broke out in as Congo's civil war came to a close. A U.S. blogger who wrote against religious fundamentalism was hacked to death in Bangladesh's capital. Police say Abhijit Roy and his wife, Rafida Ahmed, were attacked late Thursday after leaving a book fair at Dhaka University. Ahmed was seriously wounded in the attack. The Bangladesh Daily Star reported there were witnesses to the attack, but no one came forward to help the couple or apprehend the assailants. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. Talks between U.S. and Cuban diplomats opened Friday in Washington, exploring the possibility of restoring diplomatic ties between the two countries after 5 decades of estrangement. Talks are part of President Obama's initiative to end the trade embargo against Cuba. A senior State Department official said Friday's session would focus solely on opening embassies in Washington and Havana as quickly as possible. Officials said progress depends in part on what the Cubans bring to the table. Cuba has said it is linking the embassy issue to whether the U.S. drops it from the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism. The officials said the U.S. delegation is not linking the two issues and that the review of the terrorism list is a separate, ongoing process. That's going to wrap up our program for today. Thanks so much for joining us for International Edition. Get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington.